Let's go on to whatever the next chapter is numerically. It's time to turn now to protein synthesis. And in this opening slide, we can see a schematic representation of what is this called? Someone knows this, I'm sure. The central dogma. Right. The central dogma says that there is a unidirectional flow of information. Well, the original central dogma said that there is a unidirectional flow of information from DNA to RNA to protein. And so the original dogma was just this part right here with these unidirectional arrows. It didn't have this circular one. That's not strictly true, though, we've learned eventually, right? Now, it is true that usually the flow of information is from DNA and then to RNA. RNA holds the information, which then flows to the protein. The information, of course, is the sequences. There's information in DNA that is the particular sequence of DNA nucleotides. RNA has its information in its own sequence. Well, that information gets encoded in the form of a specific sequence of amino acids in the polypeptide that's coded. This is assuming we're talking about a protein coding gene, which are most of your genes. So this first straight arrow between DNA and RNA represents the process of transcription. Right? That's what transcription is, the creation of an RNA molecule using the information that's in a DNA molecule. That's only one of DNA's jobs, though, right? As we've been saying, the other job is replication. So that's why you have the circular arrow. Information also flows from DNA back to DNA, because as a cell readies for the next generation of cells that it splits into, it needs to copy itself so that those new cells are viable. They have a complete library of their own. So notice that the only arrows directly connected to DNA are transcription and replication. Like we've been saying, those are the only jobs that DNA is directly involved in. But we've also said many times that protein synthesis involves two major steps, right? Transcription and translation. It's just that DNA is only directly involved in one of those. But DNA holds the original information, which is why we routinely say that DNA gives you your traits, right? It's only indirectly true, though. DNA allows your cells to know what kind of proteins to make, but it's the proteins that give you your traits. Well, transcription and translation are sometimes confused by students. Can't remember which one refers to which other one. And just as always, what you should do is pay attention to what the words mean. And you won't be confused, hopefully. I mean, they're confusable because they both start in trans, but think about what they mean. To transcribe means to rewrite, right? A transcript is just a rewritten account of something that's been said. If you order a transcript from an English-speaking television show, you'll get an English-written transcript of what was said. It's not a change in language. It's just a rewriting. And that's appropriate here because when a gene is transcribed, you're not really changing the language, maybe changing the dialect, but not the language. You're working, the information originally encoded in DNA is in the language of nucleotides. So when you transcribe that into a messenger RNA molecule, you're still working with nucleotide language. It's just rewritten. All right? On the other hand, translation obviously refers to a change in language. And that's an appropriate descriptor here because now you're going from the language of nucleotides to the language of amino acids. That's what the polypeptide is, right? It's a sequence of amino acids. So that's why these words were used originally, and that's how you should think of them to keep them straight. But they're also ordered temporally, right? Transcription occurs first as part of protein synthesis, because you have to have that messenger RNA molecule to carry the code for it to be interpreted by the translator, which is what thing in the cell?
Ribosome.
The ribosome is the translator of the cell. It's able to interpret the language of nucleotides in the RNA molecule and specify the order of amino acids, which is like changing the language. So, yeah, this is the way things normally happen, but strictly speaking, you should actually have a double-headed arrow between DNA and RNA. And that's because it's possible for information to flow retrograde, in reverse, from RNA to DNA. And what sort of things does that happen for?
Viruses.
What specific kind of viruses? Retroviruses, right, which is why they're called retro, backward viruses. Retroviruses allow for flow of information from RNA to DNA, meaning that DNA can be made using the code that's in RNA. What does that require? What kind of enzyme is required there?
Reverse transcriptase.
Reverse transcriptase, which is a good name for it, right? Because it does the opposite of what transcription does. Transcription normally takes information from DNA and makes an RNA out of it. Reverse transcriptase is an enzyme that reads RNA code and produces a DNA molecule out of it. So that's why this middle arrow should really be double-headed. But this is the way things normally work. And keep in mind that this, if we're talking about all three of these parts, then what we're specifically talking about DNA-wise is a protein-coding gene. There are non-protein-coding genes, like I said, but in that case, it would end at RNA, right? The other kinds of RNA besides messenger RNA, that would be the end of the information flow. The only kind of RNA, in other words, that specifies how to make a protein is specifically messenger RNA. Okay, to two now. Well, we can see this flow of information in the process of protein synthesis. Protein synthesis can also be called gene expression because genes aren't always turned on, right? When they get turned on, they become expressed, as we say. That means they get transcribed. And assuming that it's a protein-coding gene, the corresponding messenger RNA gets translated into to a polypeptide. Well, so we see transcription happening first, of course, using the information in the DNA. But notice that there are three different kinds of RNA that are involved in this overall protein synthesis process. Now, that's not to say that there are three types of RNA total. There's many more than that. But there are three types of RNA just used to make a protein. And those, as you doubtless already know, are tRNA, transfer RNA, mRNA, messenger RNA, and rRNA, ribosomal RNA. Now, messenger RNA, obviously you need to carry the code. So what do we call a messenger RNA molecule? It's another name for it. We call it the messenger RNA what? We call it the transcript. It is the transcript. It is now the code that we're going to use, but it's called the transcript because transcription created it. The code is meaningless, though, unless you can do something with that. So you need rRNA, obviously, as a component of a ribosome. That's why it's called ribosomal RNA. A ribosome is more than just rRNA, though. What else makes up rRNA? I mean, what else makes up a ribosome? Proteins, right. So any given ribosome, which differ between the domains slightly, but any given ribosome, which is a two-part thing, right? There's a large and a small subunit. Well, each of those two subunits is a mixture of ribosomal RNA and proteins. So you not only need three kinds of RNA to make a protein, you also need proteins to make protein, to make additional protein. That's why you have ribosomal proteins coming in here from the side to complex with multiple rRNA molecules to make a ribosome. What about transfer RNA? What's its job? Exactly, to carry amino acids, either singly or multiply, which we'll talk more about later, but a tRNA will be connected to either nothing or to an amino acid, and that amino acid can be by itself or it can be strung together with other amino acids. In any case, a transfer RNA is called a transfer RNA because it's carrying the amino acids, it's transferring them to the growing chain of amino acids, which is the emerging polypeptide. And that is what translation is. Right? Translation is the assembly of these amino acids in a specific sequence specified by the information in the messenger RNA so that it is the correct protein. It's not just a random collection of amino acids. So a translation event creates one polypeptide. Now, you know that certain proteins are just a single polypeptide, right? In which case, there might be a slight modification of that polypeptide, but it's otherwise, as soon as it assumes its three-dimensional shape, is ready to go. But then there are quaternary proteins as well, right? Multimeric proteins. And if you have a dimer, what are the two possibilities of a dimer?
Hetero
and homo dimers, right. If you have a homodimer, then really all you need to do is use two copies that have resulted from the same gene, right? But if you have a heterodimer, or a heterotetramer, or whatever it is, then that really requires two genes, a gene for each, or two or more genes, depending on how many subunits there are. A gene for each of the peptides, right, or the polypeptides. So that means independent transcriptions and then translations to make the different kinds of polypeptides, which are then assembled into the multimeric protein. That's what's happening on the bottom here. That's just for certain proteins. Okay, now to three. Well, the fundamental difference, of course, between prokaryotic and eukaryotic cells is the absence or presence of membrane-bounded organelles, including the nucleus. And the nucleus is particularly important here because the nucleus, if it exists, which it does in the eukaryotic cell, is where the DNA is, right? Where the DNA is has to be where the transcription occurs, because transcription directly involves DNA. In a prokaryotic cell, that DNA is part of the cytoplasm, right? It's in the nucleoid. We say in the nucleoid, but that's not its own chamber, right? It's not membrane enclosed. So the DNA is in the only compartment that the prokaryotic cell has. So transcription occurs there, of course, in the cytoplasm, whereas in a eukaryotic cell, transcription occurs in what? Well, yes, in the nucleus, but what is the stuff that fills the nucleus called? The nucleoplasm, correct. So eukaryotic cell has cytoplasm and nucleoplasm, and other compartments as well, by the way, but those are the two major ones. So that's one difference. Transcription occurs in the nucleoplasm in a eukaryotic cell, in the cytoplasm in a prokaryotic cell. Another major difference, though, is that the messenger RNA that a prokaryotic cell produces via transcription is pretty much ready to go out of the box. It's ready for translation. In other words, there is no need in a prokaryotic cell for what is called post-transcriptional modification of the messenger RNA. It's in its mature form. The messenger RNA is in its mature form right away. On the other hand, in a eukaryotic cell, there is multiple things that need to be done as part of this post-transcriptional modification. And therefore, the messenger RNA that comes off of the transcription assembly line in a eukaryotic cell is called pre-mRNA to indicate that it is not in its mature form. It's not ready for translation yet. It has to be modified. Well, even if it didn't have to be modified, it wouldn't be ready for translation yet simply because it's in the nucleus and the ribosomes are out in the cytoplasm. Translation occurs in the cytoplasm in both types of cells. Well, that's the same compartment as transcription for a prokaryotic cell, but it's a different compartment in a eukaryotic cell. But aside from just having to get out of the nucleus, the RNA, the messenger RNA, is actually modified in a eukaryotic cell, which is why we say that it changes from being pre-mRNA to mature mRNA, which is we just call mRNA. And we'll talk about the processing steps that occur when we get to that detail, but part of that processing actually allows it to get out of the nucleus and into the cytoplasm where the translation occurs. So that's another fundamental difference, that you have to get the thing out of, you have to get the messenger RNA out of the nucleus in a eukaryotic cell for translation to occur. Because messenger RNA doesn't need to be modified in a prokaryote, and because translation occurs in the same chamber, compartment, cytoplasm, as transcription does, that means that as soon as enough messenger RNA gets strung off of the assembly line, even before the messenger RNA is completely transcribed, as soon as there's enough room for a ribosome to clamp onto it, it will. And you can see that translation in a prokaryote starts before transcription even ends. All right? And these three ribosomes are simultaneously transcribing the same messenger RNA before it's even completely transcribed and creating three copies of the same polypeptide. The little beads that are coming off, those are the polypeptides. And they're different lengths because these ribosomes have translated to a different degree. They all started at the same place, but they're not. They've moved on at different speeds. All right. Well, because that can happen, this is slide 4, because that can happen in prokaryotic cells, namely that you can have ribosomes hanging off of a messenger RNA that is still connected because it's not even done yet to the DNA, we call this whole complex a polyribosome. Right? So the polyribosome is a single strand of messenger RNA and multiple ribosomes that are attached to it simultaneously but at different points translating that messenger RNA. So you have DNA, one strand of DNA here, and this one strand of DNA represents one gene in a bacterium, for instance, a prokaryotic cell. So this is all one gene, therefore it all specifies the same protein, right? You have multiple RNA polymerase molecules, and these are the enzymes that are responsible for transcription, spaced out in this same gene. So each of these RNA polymerase molecules is going to give rise to exactly the same copy of messenger RNA. That's why there are four different red lines here. They're different lengths because these things are at different points in the race, right? So all the four red messenger RNAs are identical, and they'll eventually all be complete, but they're not yet complete. Meanwhile, each copy of the messenger RNA has multiple ribosomes already starting to translate it into polypeptides. And so this is why prokaryotes can get their proteins made pretty quickly, right? You make multiple copies of the polypeptide for each polyribosome, and there are multiple polyribosomes being simultaneously transcribed from this original DNA. You can get a lot of things done quickly. You don't have to process the messenger RNA. You don't have to export it out of a nucleus. 5. More about mutations. The wild type sequence on the top is called wild type simply because that's the version of DNA that's found in the majority of a population. Now you can think of it as unmutated DNA, but it certainly has been mutated itself, right? That's why that species exists, is because of mutation. But with respect to the mutations that happen below it, you can think of it as unmutated. There are many different levels of mutation. Mutations can happen to just individual nucleotides, in which case we call them point mutations. There are much larger scale mutations, chromosomal mutations, that we'll talk about in a different chapter. Any mutation, of course, changes things because you're messing around with the code that's in DNA. But point mutations, even though they seem very small, and they are in terms of the actual change that's occurring, can have profound effects because of the way the code gets read. In the language of DNA, it's analogous to language that we use, like English. But one big difference is that whereas English has multiple different lengths of words, all the words in DNA are three-letter, which is why this sentence is made up of only three-letter words, just to strengthen the analogy. So our big red dog bit the old man is the intended meaning of this wild-type sequence of nucleotides. Now we're that's the wild type, okay? Point mutations can be of different variety. There are substitutions, which will turn one base into another base. In other words, you're changing the letter, swapping one letter for the original wild-type letter, and in a substitution, you're not changing the length of the letters. There's still the same number of letters, right? So the length of the DNA doesn't change. And that doesn't have as profound effect as either an insertion or a deletion mutation. And that's because an insertion and a deletion changes the number of total DNA nucleotides you have. Insertions obviously put an additional nucleotide in between two that were there originally. So that increases the overall number of letters that you have. Whereas a deletion does just the opposite. It takes one without replacing it. And so makes the whole sequence shorter. Well, those two things, insertions and deletions, cause frame shift. A frame shift refers to what's happening here with the sentences, by analogy. So the plus here represents an insertion mutation. If you insert an X into this sentence between the R of our and the B of big, but you still, because of this three-letter word rule, have to read it with a frame of reference based on triplets, then it turns it into nonsense, right? First word is still intact because that's upstream of where the mutation occurred. But it turns it into our XBI, GRE, and so on. In other words, frame shifts are more profound in their effect because they affect not only that word, but all the other words downstream of it. The same thing happens for a deletion mutation. It's just that it's moving the frame in the opposite direction. Now, what do these words actually represent in reality? The words of the sentence on the right. Well, what are they?
Amino acids,
right. Each word in the sentence corresponds to an amino acid in the polypeptide. The sentence is the polypeptide. Each word is an amino acid. And when you change the words, obviously that's going to change the sentence in the language sense. Well, it also changes the polypeptide, right? And it will have a different shape and therefore will work differently or not at all. Or maybe get lucky even better. And that's why we're here, right? By evolution. These mistakes that happen that just by chance make a protein even better at doing its job than the wild type is the one that's going to be favored by natural selection, and that's causes speciation eventually. Now, so the words not only matter, changing them into different words obviously is going to make a difference, right? But also just the order of the words matters, which is not really shown here. You can have exactly the correct amino acids, but if they're in a different order, different sequence within the polypeptide, that's going to matter as well. The analogy with language there would be, for instance, if I say, "What on earth are you doing?" That means something totally different from, what are you doing on earth? Right? Using exactly the same words, but in a different order. So, the particular amino acids matter for the function of a protein, so does the order of those amino acids. Oh, by the way, notice the triple mutant at the bottom. If you have one or two mutations that are insertions or deletions, you cause a frame shift, and therefore that causes all kinds of changes. If you happen to actually have either three individual insertion or deletion mutations, or an insertion of three nucleotides in one position, or any multiple of three, six, or nine, or so on, then you actually have less of an effect. You'll affect a word, certainly, but because you've shifted the frame over one complete normal frame, that means the rest of the words will still be intact. That protein will operate differently, but maybe it'll be an unnoticeable difference because that might be an amino acid that is really doesn't matter to the function. It depends. Now to six. Well, we're comparing here non-overlapping code with overlapping code, which are two possibilities. DNA could be used either non-overlapping or overlapping. I mean, it could have been used that way in evolutionary history. Which way is it actually used? It's used in a non-overlapping way. And one reason is that it allows for much less confusion, basically, or much less damage is done by mutation in a non-overlapping code versus an overlapping code. In an overlapping code, you shift over just one letter, but still read three letters at a time. All right? So AUG is the first word, but then the U and the G of AUG is used as the first and second of the second word. So the words overlap each other. Right? UGG, and then GGG, and then GGC, and so on. Well, it could work that way molecularly. But if it had evolved that way, then any mutation is going to affect three words at a minimum, right? Rather than just one word as at a minimum. And so that would cause more informational damage. DNA uses a non-overlapping code, not overlapping. Okay, now seven. Here we have basically the process of protein synthesis, or at least for a small section of the protein. And the DNA is at the top. Messenger RNA is produced by that via transcription. And then the protein is assembled one amino acid at a time via translation. But the importance here is that there is a one-to-one relationship between DNA and RNA when it comes to the members of the code. In other words, one nucleotide in DNA corresponds to one nucleotide in the messenger RNA. And that makes sense because there are four DNA nucleotide types because of four nitrogenous bases normally used. And there are also four in RNA. It's not the same four, but it's four. It's a four-to-four relationship and therefore reducible to one-to-one. On the other hand, what that means, therefore, is that one nucleotide in DNA stands for one nucleotide in messenger RNA. Now, it would be much simpler if we could have one nucleotide in messenger RNA stand for one amino acid. We can't do that, though. For what reason? There's 20 what? Yeah, there are 20 biological amino acids that biological proteins are made out of, right? That's more than four. So yeah, you could say that a nucleotide stands for an amino acid, but you'd run out of nucleotides after just four amino acids. How do you specify the other 16? That's why there's not a one-to-one relationship when it comes to translation. Well, the next less simple solution of the problem would be to use a sequence of two nucleotides, right, to specify your amino acids. But how many possible combinations are there then? If there are four nucleotides, how many two nucleotide sequences are there? Possible. 16. 4 times 4. There's 4 choices of the second one for every one of the 4 first choices. So it's 4 times 4. 4 squared. Well, 16 is still fewer than 20. So that's not a solution, really. Therefore, the simplest possible way of encoding all 20 biological amino acids is to use a sequence of 3 DNA or messenger RNA nucleotides, which of course corresponds to 3 DNA nucleotides in the original gene. And so that gives you how many possibilities? 64. 4 times 4 times 4. 4 cubed is 64, which is plenty. It's actually way more than you need, right? But 16 is not enough, so you have to have the 64. I mean, you have to have the triplet, as it's called, a 3 nucleotide sequence to specify a single amino acid. And what do we call these triplets in messenger RNA? Codons. Right. So the words, the things I've been calling words in the analogy up to this point, are actually properly called codons. Now, some people use the word codon also to refer to a triplet in the DNA. There is a corresponding triplet for every mRNA triplet, of course, there is a corresponding triplet in the DNA. You can call that codon, but codon is more properly, the word codon is more properly used to describe a triplet in the messenger RNA, because that codon is directly coding for a specific amino acid of the polypeptide that's being built. Oh, by the way, when we read codons, or when we read messenger RNA, we read it in the 5' to 3' direction, which is exactly the direction in which it's built, right? Because you can only add nucleotides, whether it's DNA or RNA, to the 3' end. So this 5' to 3' direction is the direction in which this messenger RNA got built to begin with in the transcription process. That's the way the codons are read also by the ribosome, though, to lay down the sequence of amino acids. So AUG is the first codon, GGC is the next, and so on. And the N and the C mean what? The N terminus and the C terminus. Right? You have an amino end of any peptide, polypeptide, and you have a carboxyl end as well. Slide 8 shows you the genetic code. And I stress the word "the" here because it's almost without exception the universal genetic code that all organisms use. Very few exceptions to this have evolved, and they evolved later on. The overwhelming majority of organisms that have ever existed use this genetic code, which is one of the bits of information that points to all organisms having a common ancestor, right? That original cell is what gave rise to all of us eventually. So we all use this genetic code. And when you look at it in table form like this, it's really just an exhaustive list of codons. It's all 64 possible combinations of sequence of 3 RNA nucleotides. So notice there's no T's in any of these, because messenger RNA is RNA, and RNA uses A's, C's, G's, and U's, not T's. And so, like I said, we read this thing from the 5' to 3' direction. So what's considered first position here, that's the 5' end of the codon, and then the middle position and the 3' end is the third position. Of these 64 codons, 61 of them specify, or 61 of them tell the cell to lay down an amino acid. So 61 of them actually are codons that correspond to amino acids, that specify amino acids. 3 of them have a special job of being stop codons. And so they don't specify any amino acid. The word stop is put there to indicate that they will instruct the ribosome to quit translating. In other words, when any of these three stop codons is encountered by a ribosome, that ribosome will understand that as meaning that the last amino acid that was just hooked on was the last amino acid that should be hooked, and the polypeptide is complete, in other words. At least it's complete with respect to the ribosome. The polypeptide that's released by the ribosome can be modified, and usually is, after translation, but we're talking about just in terms of translation, it's complete when any of the three stop codons is encountered. There are three different stop codons, but it doesn't matter which one is encountered, they all do the same job. One of them is listed as the start codon, which is AUG. The start codon actually does double duty. It specifies that this is where you should start reading the codons and put down amino acids. So that's why it's the start codon. But it also, anytime it's encountered within that messenger RNA molecule, anytime that word comes up or codon comes up, it specifies methionine as the amino acid. Now, 64 is way more than 20. So you have way more than you need to work with, way more codons than you need to work with. Therefore, the genetic code is redundant, but importantly, it is not ambiguous. To be redundant means, in terms of the genetic code, that there are, in a lot of cases, more than one codon that specify the same amino acid. In language terms, this is analogous to synonyms, right? There's a lot of different ways of saying big, for instance. You don't have to use the word big. It has the same meaning. So, for instance, there's a lot of different ways you can say, tell the ribosome arginine is the correct amino acid here. You can use CGU, CGC, and so on. That's redundancy. The genetic code is not ambiguous, though, importantly. What does it mean to be ambiguous? Unclear by virtue of multiple possible meanings, right? That's what ambiguous means. It doesn't mean just unclear. Means unclear because it could be taken several ways, right? And the analogy I usually use as a sentence is, if I say that I'm hot, I could mean my body temperature is elevated. It could mean that I'm very angry. Could mean that I'm a very popular celebrity at the moment. Or the obvious one, I'm sexually attractive. But any one of those could be interpreted from the sentence, I'm hot. Well, that's okay in language, but it would not be okay in the genetic code. If genetic code were ambiguous, then that would mean a codon would specify one amino acid one time, and then that same codon would specify a different amino acid the next time. You'd end up making the wrong proteins.